You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Welcome to MLB.com Extras, the NL West. I'm Allison Fritter from MLB.com, and we are in all-star mode. So let's look ahead to some of the players that are going to be on the all-star team. Very good representation from the NL West. Of course, Bruce Bochy being the manager. So there are four representatives from the San Francisco Giants. There are also the same amount for the Los Angeles Dodgers, including Jock Peterson, who is an up-and-coming Rookie of the Year candidate who has also committed to being in the Home Run Derby. So that's very exciting for everyone. The Padres are going to look to begin the second half on a better note. And the Rockies actually have a couple of nice representatives in the All-Star game, too, as do the Diamondbacks. So that is a quick look at the All-Star version of the NL West. Here with Ken Gernick, covers the Dodgers for MLB.com and all of those All-Stars coming from Los Angeles. The big news, of course, Clayton Kershaw did not make the cut for the team that has already been announced, but he is one of the finalists for the final vote. I do like your story. You just gave the bullet points as to why he should be an All-Star, and they're very strong arguments. Were you surprised that he didn't make the team? And there's a lot of people who are upset that he didn't make the team and that are upset that he has to make the team this way through the final vote. What was your reaction to that?
Well, I take Zach Greinke's position. I'm never surprised by anything with the All-Star game. So nothing is a surprise to me. I think that his one loss record, even though it's not indicative of the way he's pitched, that didn't help him. And it probably didn't help him that Bruce Bochy is the manager, you know, because that's always been a point of contention about whether Bruce Bochy appreciates Clayton Kershaw or not, you know, and Kershaw's never started an All-Star game, and now he might not even be in one. But all that said, you know, there still is a chance for the fans to put him in. It's pretty unusual for the reigning MVP not to be in the All-Star game. You kind of wonder what is an All-Star game if the MVP isn't in it, but there's a few days for the fans to rectify that.
Yeah, that's interesting because, you know, you look at Kershaw's numbers and you look at everything that he's done this year, and certainly they're in line or better than a lot of the guys who made the All-Star team, and it's almost like Kershaw set a standard for himself that is not really sustainable. I mean, it'd be wonderful if he could repeat last year, but my goodness, I mean, he was almost flawless last year. And so, yeah, I mean, I guess in that respect, you would think that he might run away with this thing in the final vote, but I guess we can't really tell. I mean, do you think that he's got the best chance of all those guys?
Well, again, I can't predict that. When you see what's happened in Kansas City, right. It's kind of hard to predict what fans are going to do, and I'm not going to try. You know, I think one thing that is kind of curious to me about the All-Star game and the voting and the selection is that the All-Star game is played in July, and then the vote takes place the next year, and very often everything that happens from July on for the previous year is not factored in. If you're going to factor that in, you know, so then what you've got is you've got an All-Star game based on 3 months. And if that's the way, you know, the fans want it to be, so be it. But then that takes a guy who had a great second half, like Clayton Kershaw, and it's not going to get recognized as far as the voting goes. And I think that's, you know, what's happened here. Unfortunately, that second half of his in the minds of the voters really didn't matter. You know, they look at his numbers for the first half this year and they feel he's not worthy. So I think, you know, I think it's kind of unfortunate that the second half of a player's season is not factored in when the All-Star team is created.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you, and I used to be sort of on the side of just looking at the guys and what they've done in the first half, but I think that the Kershaw situation has just opened a lot of eyes, including mine, that he certainly should be representing the National League as one of the stars of the game today. But let's move on to some of the other All-Stars. I love that Jock Peterson made the team. I mean, I think we all sensed that he was going to, but it's great to see that he did, and being a rookie. And wants to be in the Home Run Derby, which I'm really excited about. He wants to be in, Chris Bryant wants to be in, And it's nice to see that the young guys, this is becoming, I mean, there's so many all-stars that are like under the age of 25. It's nice to see that these guys want to be in the Home Run Derby and sort of showcase their talents and to show the fans kind of what's coming in the future.
Well, I think that the young players are more excited about the All-Star game almost always, and that's just naturally some of the veterans who have been there four, five, six times. You know, as great of an honor as it is, the novelty wears off. And for a guy like Peterson, you know, who hasn't participated even in the minor leagues, really, you know, for him to get this in his first year in the major leagues and then have an opportunity, it appears, to be in the Home Run Derby. And as he mentioned, with his season, really, he's an all-star because of his home runs. I mean, he's barely hitting 230, you know, but he's got great power numbers and a great OPS. And what I've mentioned before is it doesn't seem to get much attention, but his defense really is what has made as great an impact as his home runs, if not greater, to the Dodgers winning. He's probably the best center fielder they've had in decades. And while that may only be on display for a couple innings and it's going to draw as much attention as the home run prowess, I think if you asked any of the pitchers that he plays behind, they would say that his defense is as important as anything he's done. So, you know, what you really have there is outside of the batting average, you've got the complete package player, and this is just his first year. So if he can work on the average, he really can become the complete ball player.
Absolutely. And I just want to ask you about Yasmani Grandal. I mean, we had talked about him just being so good for this team and being really a stabilizer behind the plate. Was he surprised at all that he was named an All-Star? I mean, he seemed to be so excited about it, and he's canceling a vacation, and he's very honored. Was he surprised at all to see that he made
it? Well, he must have been surprised enough that he made plans to go to Las Vegas. So
that's true.
I guess to that extent, you know, or maybe, you know, that was a backup plan. I don't know. I think he was, I think he's proud of it. I think coming back from an injury and then from a real tough month of April in which it clearly was pressing after being traded for Matt Kemp and struggling and pressing, and he kind of got back to his game and he's provided some real power and, you know, he really accomplished what that trade was set out to do, and that was to upgrade the offense behind the plate. You know, A.J. Ellis had done a great job defensively, and he had some promising years offensively. But Grandal is a 20-plus home run type player, as he's showing now. And there aren't a lot of those behind the plate. And so the Dodgers really feel they've upgraded there, clearly offensively. And, you know, whether he was surprised or not, he obviously is proud of what he's done. And he's going to be happy to go back there, Cincinnati, his original team. So it kind of ties it all up nice. And the Dodgers, I think, were pleased to have four and with a possible five, considering that they didn't have any voted onto the starting lineup.
Yeah. Oh, good for him. All right, Ken, thank you so much. And enjoy the All-Star break, and we'll talk to you when the season resumes.
Okay, thanks, Allison.
Chris, not surprising that there are a lot of Giants on this team, both because there's a lot of good players, also because the manager of the Giants is also managing the National Leaguers. So that's a pretty nice selection that we have. Madison Bumgarner, Brandon Crawford, Joe Panik, Buster Posey. So I guess you're not surprised that there's that many on the team.
Not at all. And it's, to coin a phrase, a very representative representation. I mean, you've got the record-setting pitcher from last year's World Series championship team. You've got the acknowledged, I guess, leader of the team, along with Hunter Pence, you would say, and Buster Posey, and two first-timers in Brandon Crawford and Joe Panik, who happen to be the team's double-play combination, second baseman Joe Panik and shortstop Brandon Crawford. So, yeah, so it's a pretty complete group.
Yeah, that's kind of cool that you've got the double play combination there that's going to be representing the Giants. I guess that's neat. Was there a lot of talk about that right after the selections were made?
A lot of talk about it. And people, you know, the thing that was great was that Brandon Crawford was selected by the players, so it was not a fluke there. And I don't remember where Joe Panik finished in the players' vote, but he couldn't have been too far off, you know, actually getting in. So, you know, even with a player's vote. But that's where Bruce Bochy used his discretion. He really didn't have that many choices, but he felt compelled to use one of them in panic. And I think given Joe's statistics, you know, he leads all second basemen at OPS. It's very fair.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but these players were all drafted and developed by the Giants, right?
You are not wrong. They were all drafted and developed by the Giants, and I think I know the organization is very proud of that. This is the same organization which about 10 years ago, you know, people were saying, why can't they develop a position player? They might still be saying now, why can't they develop an outfielder? But at least they've got, you know, they're pretty much taking care of every place else.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a tip of the cap to the Giants organization, and we know how strong it's been for so long, and it's all about player development, scouting, and they've done so many things right. I was watching Bruce Bochy on the selection show, and you know, I mean, it can be an agonizing process. It's a process that every manager would like to go through because it means they won the pennant the year before. But how hard is it for the manager to take, to finish off the roster? He's got like 8 selections or something like that. He wants to take his own guys, but he's got to be fair and take deserving all-stars. Did he say anything about this, how tough of a process this is?
Not this year. And I think maybe I'll go a little bit far here, but remember he had those 2 stents put in near his heart in spring training. I think this year he's made a conscious effort to try to avoid stress as much as possible, and that includes up to and including selecting the All-Star team. In past years, he would bellyache a little bit, and of course, as you said, not bellyaching about the responsibility because it means you were in the World Series the previous year. In his case, he won the World Series the previous year, but the previous 2 times he managed the team, I think he worried a lot more about what he was doing, about what he had to do. Now he's taking it more in stride, and I think it was a more painless process for him this year.
And we'll talk more about the second half and looking ahead, but I do want to ask you about Hunter Pence because he has returned, and he has returned with a vengeance, it appears. So he's right back at it. How did he look in his first time back after coming off the DL?
Excellent. I mean, his very first game back, he made one of the defensive plays of the year, flat out. It's one of the best plays I've seen in my baseball watching life. He made a diving catch in the right field bullpen there at AT&T Park. But it wasn't just that. It was that he, sprang up and made this throw on the fly home that nailed Curtis Granderson of the Mets. It was just a combination of the catch and the throw, which is something you'd say about a guy like Willie Mays or something like that, Hunter did it in his first game back. It was remarkable. It was a remarkable play under any circumstances. At the plate, he looks pretty sharp. He chases a few pitches, but then again, that wouldn't be Hunter if he didn't chase a few pitches. So overall, it's a successful return, but that lasted all of 18, 19 games the last time, and he had to quit. So now they're hoping he can stick around the rest of the year, of course.
Of course, yes. We wouldn't expect anything less from Hunter. So, okay. Well, Chris, thanks so much. Enjoy the break, and we will talk to you when the season resumes.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks. Here with Corey Brock, and who covers the Padres, of course, for MLB.com. And Corey, I think that this is not like a huge surprise that Justin Upton is an all-star, that he is the Padres' representative. He leads the team in every important category, offensive category, as you noted. And it's kind of interesting because the beginning of the season, like before it started, everyone thought, well, he's the only like visiting player that really hit well at Petco. And it seems like he's really lived up to the billing in that way. He's kind of figured that ballpark out and worked it to his advantage.
Yeah, and I think maybe that was one of the reasons they went out and got him. One of many reasons, and not the primary one. They needed some offensive help, as we've gone on and on about. over the last few months and felt like he was an interesting piece and a guy that could bolster the offense. But, you know, I'm sure they looked at the splits and realized that, hey, this guy's had a lot of success at Petco Park. You know, I think this is worth a gamble. And sure enough, you know, he's hit nearly all of his home runs at Petco Park, which is not an easy place to elevate a baseball and get it out of the ballpark. So he's done a really nice job of that, been a run producer. Tailed off a little bit in June, Allison, but it's been good on the bases, pretty good defensively. He's been everything as advertised.
I guess it's a little bit bittersweet, I would imagine. You know, not shocking that the Padres just have one All-Star representative, but clearly this is not how they had envisioned, you know, sort of the halfway mark, just being that many games below 500, and just it's been a disappointing season, as we have talked about. But was there kind of any disappointment at all that there's only like one representative, or is that sort of par for the course when you have a struggling team?
Yeah, I think if there's any disappointment that there's only one representative, it's just because all these other guys haven't lived up to expectation, more so than there's any sort of oversight here. I don't feel that's the case, and I'm sure you know, others looking at the situation wouldn't say that so-and-so in that clubhouse absolutely deserves to be on this All-Star team. I think it was Upton and really only Upton. But, yeah, as you're assembling this team in December, February, you sign James Shields. April, you trade for Craig Kimbrell right before opening day. I'm sure they were probably envisioning three or four guys if they were all going well. But as we've talked about, not a whole lot has gone well, and this team has largely underperformed in the first half.
Let's talk about James Shields. I found the article that you wrote about his last start at Pittsburgh very interesting. Yeah, I didn't realize his ERA was that high. Nine road starts entering that game was 5.50, but he had a really good start against the Pirates. And you said he traded some strikeouts for some ground ball outs. Is this like, was that, you said it was not really by design so much, but was this, is this kind of a change for him in his approach, or was that, have you kind of seen really just the same James Shields throughout the season?
It might have been the same James Shields. I don't think he had nearly as a lively four-seamer yesterday. The two-seamer led to a lot of ground ball outs, and then maybe sort of realizing that you know, the Pirates hitters were aggressive and they were putting the ball in play early. So, you know, a lot of that isn't so much always what the pitcher's doing and what he has working that day, but there's the other side of it, too. You have another team you're facing, and you know, and they're trying to score runs and probably figured the best way to do that was to get on him early in the count. But, yeah, I think it was his best overall start of the year. You know, just two hits allowed in seven innings. One was an infield single. You know, hard luck. Well, it wasn't a hard luck loss. He got a no decision. But, yeah, the unearned run got him, and that's sort of been the story with these guys this year, Allison. They lead the major leagues in unearned runs allowed this year, and yeah, defense has let them down. They don't have the most errors in baseball, but it seems like at really critical times, the defense has really let them down.
Yeah, I think that it's important to note that you can overcome a lot from a pitching and offensive standpoint, especially from an offensive standpoint, if you have flawless defense. That can win you a lot of baseball games. So that kind of leads me to my second question, which I think is what you just answered, but just looking ahead to the second half, what needs to go right? It's kind of like wanted to leave that open-ended, just to sort of key areas to improve. I know the starting rotation was definitely supposed to be better than it is, but if you had to pinpoint one thing that really needs to turn around, what would you say that is?
Yeah, I guess if you're just asking for one thing, it would have to be overall offensive production and some consistency there. They've been shut out 13 times. You know, I think they feel like, by and large, they have the right guys in the clubhouse in order to get this thing turned around. I don't think it's a personnel issue so much, but an underachieving and underperforming component that's really gotten this team off track. You know, Allison, they could look like world beaters one day and put up a crooked number on the scoreboard, and then they're flat the next day, and there's just been no semblance of consistency this year. I think we all recognize that they had some guys in the lineup that were going to strike out some, but I don't think anyone envisioned a scenario where they would struggle so mightily to score runs on every night.
And just looking overall, just at all of baseball, I just find it so interesting and intriguing that there are really only like maybe four or five teams that are completely out of this thing at this point. I mean, if you look at team by team, you know, being within like five or six games of that second wild card spot, it's almost everyone. That's kind of cool. I mean, you know, we talk about parity and we talk about, you know, the fact that there have been so many teams that have been in the World Series in the last 15 years or whatever the stat is. But, I mean, just from just being like a baseball observer, a writer, and a fan, I mean, it is kind of neat to see that there are still so many teams that are just kind of hanging around there. The Padres are one of them. They probably think, well, you know, we might be able to make a run at this.
Well, yeah, and Allison, I know you well enough to know that you're like me and that you enjoy seeing new blood in the playoffs every year. And I think, you know, I think this new system has sort of brokered a lot of that where, you know, a team can get hot late in the year and make a run. And now with that second wild card, anything's possible. What it's also done is it's maybe given a little bit longer leash where these teams, you know, sort of have a pretty good idea of what they are and who they are. And I'll use the Padres as an example. I think, you know, we've discussed their issues this year. And, you know, they have some trade pieces that they might want to move. But like you said, you know, still sort of hanging around and feeling like, you know, that maybe if you get the pitching and the hitting to go together for, which would be the first time all year when that happens, if and when that happens, maybe they can get on a little roll and make something happen. So, you know, I think it's given some teams a little extra hope. And maybe in some cases it's sort of generated a little false security too, Allison. You know, the deeper you move into July, at some point you have to look in the mirror and, you know, realize what you are. Are you moving forward? Is it maybe a good idea to take a step back, to take a step forward? So at some point you have one of those, what I like to call come-to-Jesus meetings, where you have to make some sort of determination and answer some hard questions. They're not there yet, as are most of these teams, but at some point this month they have to answer that question.
Yeah, it's almost like the Dodgers and the Giants are making it harder for the Padres because they're not really that good right now either. And so everyone's sort of trying to get down to 500 for whatever reason. And that makes it harder for a team that's kind of not in it, but actually is in the division race very much so because everybody's so mediocre.
Well, I couldn't understand the Dodgers. I mean, they looked right. Like, Allison, early on that they were just going to run away with this thing. And I still
yep.
think, you know, they're head and shoulders above the rest of the teams in the division. But, yeah, just kind of settling around there, not really making any moves to separate themselves. And, yeah, you're right. It's given everyone else in the division a little bit of hope.
Yeah. I think injuries are going to dictate it. Whoever is the healthiest is going to win that thing. But we shall see. Anyway, Corey, thanks so much. See you at the All-Star game. And thanks, and we'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, look forward to it. Thanks, Allison.
Here with Steve Gilbert, our beat writer, covers the Diamondbacks for MLB.com. And Steve, the All-Star teams are actually, by the time this runs, they will have been completely announced. And what can you say about Paul Goldschmidt that we didn't already talk about last week? I mean, his numbers speak for themselves, but just a fantastic player and, of course, very deserving to be a starter in the All-Star game.
Yeah, Allison, I think what is amazing to me is the number of votes that he got. I mean, getting over 9 million votes, coming from a market like Phoenix, it tells you when you realize that he's the only one of all the Diamondback players that ended up, you know, even amongst the leaders, it tells you that it was the voters across the country that supported him, not just Diamondback fans. So that's interesting to see. It's taken a couple of years, but it seems like the rest of the country kind of realizes what's out here in Arizona in terms of Paul Goldschmidt, the consistency and the way he plays the game. And clearly, judging from his totals, he's making an impression across the country.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting when you asked him about the home run derby. So I've had my philosophies on this for a long time that it does kind of mess with guys' swings if they're not careful. And he just fully kind of acknowledges that he doesn't really have a home run swing and he doesn't want to try to change things up just for this thing. Can you talk a little bit about
sure.
what he means by that?
Absolutely. If you watch him take batting practice, everything is done with a purpose. And that's one of the things that just, you know, is kind of a hallmark of his. If you just watch him around the clubhouse, everything he does has a purpose. He's always headed somewhere. And when he starts taking swings in batting practice, it's never taking swings to try to hit the ball out of the park. He's trying to hit the ball to the right field. He's trying to hit it back up the middle. He's trying to hit line drives. Sometimes home runs come, but very few home runs hit in batting practice for a guy his size and for a guy that has 20 home runs, you know, in actual games. So he doesn't feel that he has a home run swing. He doesn't really want to try to tweak his swing to start hitting home runs for the, you know, because if he starts uppercutting more, if he starts trying to hit home runs for the All-Star, you know, for the home run derby, he doesn't want that to affect him in the second half. Plus, you know, it's also, he also pointed out that it was, you know, it kind of can be a taxing thing too for guys that spend, you know, 4 hours during the home run derby swinging like that. So it was not meant as he said, you know, he's sure that there are guys that would enjoy it and guys who hit more home runs than he in batting practice. And he's all for it and he's going to stay and watch it, but it's just not something he wants to participate in. And AJ Pollock was standing next to him, when we were talking to him, and AJ, when we got done, said, "Hey, you know, Goldie, remember when you were in that home run hitting contest at the AA All-Star game?" Mm-hmm. And Goldschmidt kind of laughed, and AJ said, "Yeah, I think you hit one or two homers during that thing." So it was obvious that that was not really his game, was not, you know, to hit home runs. So that was going all the way back to his days in the minor leagues.
That's hilarious. Yeah, it's an interesting debate. I mean, there's a lot of guys that come out of the break and that participated in it, and they're not, they kind of go into like a 2 or 3 week slump, and of course everyone says it's not from the derby, but you never really know. So I do admire him for at least sticking to his guns and understanding, you know, what he is as a hitter and wanting to do that. So I want to ask about Patrick Corbin. That was a big deal, not only to make that start, to win the game, as a sellout crowd, so it couldn't have been a better atmosphere for him.
Yeah, you know, it was July 4th, big firework display after the game, so they had a sellout crowd, and he got chills when he was just kind of stretching and they were announcing the starting lineup, and when they got to him, there was just like this sudden roar from people, and it kind of caught him off guard and really gave him goosebumps, he said. So it was a nice moment for him, and then he went out and pitched a very good 5-inning. Great step for him. He was, you know, in the mid-90s with his velocity. Seemed to bounce back very well the next day. So he's excited about his next start, which will be in New York. And he's from upstate New York, so he'll have lots of friends and family at that game. So right now, he certainly seems like he's in a very good place.
And he's going to be monitored, right? I mean, he was on a – they didn't want him to go past, what, 80 or 90 pitches this last month?
Yeah. Right, they didn't want him to go past 90 pitches, and he was well under that, and they're not going to let him go more than 95 or 100 pitches at any time this season. And they're going to push him back probably when, you know, after the All-Star break, to give him put him back at the end of the rotation just to give more time off. And when there's, you know, off days, they're going to maybe try to skip him here and there, anything to kind of just get him through the rest of this year healthy. He's not going to be a guy that they're going to be leaning heavily on for innings or pitches this year, because they want to make sure he gets through it healthy and is ready for next year.
And I see that we had some, I guess, maybe encouraging news on Archie Bradley. Not bad news, sort of status quo news. Is that the way we should take this?
Yeah, you know, Dr. Andrews, you went and saw Dr. Andrews, which, you know, anytime you see a Dr. Andrews name or Dr. Andrews attached to somebody's, somebody else's name in baseball, people kind of go, oh, no. But, you know, he can kind of confirm what the Diamondbacks team doctor had said, and that there's no real structural damage in that shoulder, but that, you know, he needs to rest, and so he's doing that right now. Hopes to be back at some point, but right now there's really not a timetable. While they just kind of wait for that inflammation, tendonitis to kind of subside in the shoulder. So it was, you know, better news than had he had some structural damage. But still, you know, he's anxious to get back out on the mound right now.
I can imagine. Well, thank you very much, Steve, and enjoy the All-Star break and All-Star week, and we'll check back with you when the second half starts up.
Sounds good. Thanks, Allison.
Here for my weekly chat with Thomas Harding, our lovely beat writer who covers the Rockies. And Thomas, I just want to talk really all-star. And as we're talking, we're not exactly sure like who is filling out the rosters on the all-star team, but I just want to talk about Nolan Arenado. Is just a fantastically awesome player who I don't think a lot of people know enough about.
Yes, you know, he's won the last two Gold Glove awards, so people in the game know about him. You know, he's been on the highlight reels for ever since he got here, you know, a couple of years ago, and I think that people do know about him. It doesn't necessarily translate to voting. Some of that has to do with the struggles of the Rockies as a team on the field. Some of it has to do with, you know, other teams having, you know, huge fan bases that are really, motivated to vote because their teams are doing well. But Arenado, right now when I'm looking at him, not only is he the best fielder at third base in the game, but the fact that as we sit here now, he's leading the majors in RBIs and he has 24 home runs, it just tells me that he's kind of the old-fashioned corner infielder, big run producer who also gives you great defense. I mean, those guys come around not very often in a generation. So Nolan Arenado is very much an all-star type, and I am sure when these when the team is finally announced, and you'll probably know it by then, he'll be on it. I don't think there's any doubt.
Yeah, I'm sure it's got to be. I mean, this has been a little bit of a frustrating, not a little bit of a frustrating first half, but very frustrating first half for the Rockies. But you look kind of individually, there's a lot of really good players on this team, not just Arenado, but you know, Charlie Blackmon, and I mean, they've got some, you know, cargo, of course, too low. Are you surprised what's happening with them lately, or is this just something we thought was going to happen because the pitching was just a big question mark?
Well, you thought it was possible because of the pitching. They have picked up a bit scoring runs, but they just came off a 10-game road trip where they went 3-7 and really didn't do well offensively on that trip. But hey, that happens with this team. The issue though is always pitching, and right now it's become that rotation of Jorge, then let us pray. Jorge De La Rosa goes out and he pitches very well. Chad Bettis has been competitive, but it seems like when Jorge pitches, everybody believes, yeah, this is the Rockies' day. Other days, everybody's just kind of crossing their fingers, and that's a huge issue with this team. Now, how do you correct it? Do you make massive changes in order to get more pitching depth? That's what I'm for, because this organization has proven that they can develop pretty good offensive players. And if you take a step back and maybe make, you know, everybody talks about the big money guys, Cargo and Tulo, but maybe you even need to go a little bit deeper into the roster in making changes just so that you can get enough bodies pitching, and you just have to trust that your own development and the fact that they play at Coors Field will give you a good offense.
Did you say Jorge and then let's pray?
Yes.
Is that something you came up with, or is that sort of like in the inner circle?
That's what I came up with. I mean, that's what I've been saying for the last couple of years. I mean, I don't know. I'm intrigued by some of the guys in the rotation. Can David Hale figure out, figure things out and put everything together? Chad Bettis looks like he's developing into a major league type pitcher, and you've got the guys, Eddie Butler, who's gone back to the minors to work on some things that really he should have had time to work on before he was forced into the majors. John Gray is pitching very well down there. He's getting the AAA hitters out now. There is some finishing of development before he comes here, and I think after he gets here, there will be some struggles. But, hey, he's John Gray, and he can really throw the ball, so you want him here. So it looks like if you retooled a bit, you've got a chance maybe not to have to go all the way back like the Cubs and the Astros did, to where you have a number of years of losing. You may be able to get there fairly quickly if you get the pitching depth.
Okay, I want to talk about this Rosario play at first. So I was reading your story, and it appears – can you just explain to us what happened? And is this just like a result of him just not being very experienced over there, and this is sort of going to happen?
Yeah, that's what we were told before the season, and it was funny because when I heard that, I was thinking, this is first base, and first base is – a grossly underrated position. I mean, if you play, if you think about it, you really can't have effective defense in any way, shape, or form if your first baseman is bad. Now, he has, I think, developed into adequate at handling the throws over there. He does a pretty good job of picking up the ball. I mean, so he's not an embarrassment at first base by any stretch of the imagination. However, the prediction came true that at some point he's going to see something he hasn't seen before, and we don't know what's going to happen. And that certainly was the case. Cliff Pennington bunt it toward him. He picks it up. The catcher is pointing to first base, say, hey, go to first, because he's thinking going home. It's a squeeze play. Well, when the catcher points to first, he turns and throws to first. But he doesn't really turn. He leaps. It's a wonderful athletic play. I mean, to leap like that, heading in one direction, throw it in the other direction, and really throw a strike. The problem is there's nobody there to catch it. And what compounded the mistake was Brandon Barnes in the outfield on that play was not backing up first base. Usually, if there's a bunt and if you see a team that's totally engaged and maybe they're getting good pitching and everybody's on their toes, as soon as that bunt happens, everybody on that field is moving. Well, Brandon Barnes wasn't moving, and then the throw was even worse than, you know, it just compounded a very terrible-looking play.
Poor guy. Well, I'm guessing.
Here's what I like about Rosario is that he owned it. Yeah, I made a bad play. I will fix it next time. And his point, and this is what you see a lot in athletes, and I think one of the separators between people who accomplish something in athletics and people who end up, you know, like us analyzing it, is that if a lot of people make that play, they are embarrassed almost to the point that they're tentative the next time. I don't think Wilson Rosario is going to be tentative. Something else terrible may happen, but he's going to go at 100 miles an hour, and he will find a way through it, and eventually that's how you learn, is by making the mistakes.
Yeah, it's funny because I think the only ones, like observers of baseball, who make things seem a lot worse than they are the fans, whereas the players seem to have a pretty good grasp on the level of importance of one single moment in the big scheme of things, and we tend to not be able to see it the way they see it.
Yes, because, you know, if you're thinking about that play, then what's going to happen on the next play? And that's just simply the way that you do it, and that's when you're even working with kids, if there are kids out there listening, you're going to make a mistake. And maybe when you're walking down the hall at school, your friends are going to be saying, gee, how did you make that throw? And kind of laughing or whatever. But the way that you tend to learn in these sports is you're taught to be aggressive. And then when you make a mistake, you'll double back. Okay, what happened? But you make your mistakes fast, you run through those mistakes fast, and then you learn from them. And that's just the way the game goes.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk a little bit about Jenny Kavnar. So she is entering the broadcasting world as an analyst on the radio broadcast. So tell us about her, and this is unique. It's not unprecedented, because, of course, Susan Waldman is an analyst for the Yankees radio broadcast. But this is something new, certainly to the Rockies and new to a lot of us. So tell us about her and what her new duties are.
Yeah, well, she filled in on some games this past weekend, the three of the four games in Arizona, because one of the TV broadcasters was out, so they kind of shuffled personnel around. And Jack Corrigan, one of the voices of the Rockies, along with Jerry Schemmel, approached Jenny and said, listen, we have watched you do the interviews before the game, some of the sideline reports, and do that post-game show where she is helping analyze with several players, whether they be Ryan Spielborgs or Corey Sullivan or Jason Hirsch or Jeff Houston. And they're like, you know this game well enough. Why don't you come into our booth as an expert analyst and work these games and see how it goes? And, you know, there was a really big reaction nationwide to this. A lot of people were happy with it. And the people who have watched Jenny perform on the air here really believe that she could even be a play-by-play announcer, which, you know, ESPN has done a great job of working women into play-by-play on football and basketball. For whatever reason, we have not seen it in baseball, and frankly, I cannot think of a reason not to do it. I guess Gail Gardner did a game back in 1993, a Rockies game, in fact. And Susan has been doing a really good job on the Yankees radio for years, and she's done some television with them. So I would like to see that happen. Now, knowing Jenny, and I did ask her about this, I'm like, what about play-by-play? She's like, I'm not going to just jump in there and do play-by-play just because people want me to do it. If I'm going to do play-by-play, I'm going to practice it. I'm going to make sure that people are critiquing me as I go. So, you know, if you do hear that she will be doing play-by-play in the future, I will bet you that it will be the result of her just sitting in a booth during the games, where maybe if she's going to do post-game, she sits there during the game doing play-by-play that nobody sees, but people are teaching her to do it correctly.
That's so awesome. Well, I am rooting for her, and it's about time, in my opinion, but that's great. Great for her. Thank you so much, Thomas. We will enjoy All-Star Week, and we will talk to you when the season resumes.
All right. Talk to me then. I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you for listening to MLB.com Extras, the NL West.